Everybody, welcome to this week's episode of the OIG Roundtable. The band's back together. I can't believe it. I know I can't believe it. Wade, you got a special dispensation from the auditing bishop. And because you know, in order to any special dispensations have to come from the bishop. That's what I'm told. And so it appears the auditing bishop has given you a special dispensation. It's good to see you. Good. Yeah, it's good. We were gonna send out a team to go and a proof of life. We wanted that, like a current newspaper.
That might be a big ask, asking for proof of life on this contract. But
it is true. I mean, generally speaking, proof of life is a challenge these days. So,
I was going to send you a St. Bernard with a cask of brandy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it is August and summer is coming to an end in Wisconsin. And so that St. Bernard might actually be of value. So, but it's good to have you back this week. I guess we'd almost call this a special episode of the ORG Roundtable, but no. So thanks. Matt and I have, if you took the time to watch the podcast in your absence, you'd know that Matt and I have been slogging through basically the functional equivalent of nailing down your foot and running around in a circle for 8 hours and then saying, God, I hope we've made the distance that we need. So it's good to have you back to move the ball and, you know, not have to listen to Matt Kachansky talk for 20 minutes is always a positive thing. So
we did spend no time making fun of you in your
house. I'm sure.
Zero. There was none. There was no.
I may have caught an episode or two where my name was used, but that's all right.
Yeah, it wasn't used in vain. I mean, it was used for proper purposes. So, anyway, we're here. We're back together. We have a good discussion for today. And so today, one of the things that we want to talk about and spend a little time on is the UPICs, Unified Program Integrity Contractors. They not only do the SIU work on behalf of Medicare from a program integrity perspective, but one of the things that the UPICs also do is serve as a check and balance on the plans that are Medicare Advantage and Medicaid participating plans. And so the UPIC has a little bit of an additional role. And in today's climate with seeking to have enhanced fraud, waste, abuse related work done. You know, we're seeing New York was decertified as a MFUKU by HHS, OIG, and Hawaii was also decertified. And we know that there are at least a number of other states that are on either the warning track or have been given warnings. And, you know, that's obviously concerning when you're trying to work on these cases and your potential budget has been cut in half or more. But one of the things from a plan perspective is that the UPICs are also very heavily engaged in doing audits of the plans themselves for the purposes of identifying whether or not the plans are operating commensurate with CMS policy and things of that sort. And the way that I think we can liken it is that it's not dissimilar to when OIG, Office of Evaluation and Inspections, or Office of Audit Services are out doing audits and reviews on the provider side, and then taking a look and seeing is CMS following its own rules when it comes to payment or directing the Medicare Administrative Contractors, known as the MACs, for things like that. And so that's what really these are. These are kind of checks and balances to make sure that the plans are operating within the CMS guidelines, following the claims processing manual, the program integrity manual, things of that sort. And so, Wade, I want to start with you because from an investigative plan SIU perspective, you know, we're hearing from a number of our plan clients, there's a lot of nervousness. There's a lot of trepidations about this. There's a lot of fear in what's going to happen as a result of this. And I think the important thing to realize is that if you're doing your job the right way, if you're following plan policies from an SIU perspective, if you're taking the proper payment integrity work and doing all of that, that these things should be just pro forma. But, you know, there are obviously always going to be areas for improvement. But, you know, generally speaking, the plan should be, you know, looking at the program integrity manual, following along with what those policies are, plan policies. But one of the areas that we know is always an area of concern is the individual contracts that providers have with the plan. So let's talk a little bit about like, do your job. Don't be nervous about it. Continue to interact with the different payment integrity teams. But also, maybe now is a time to review those individual contracts that you have with your providers.
Right. So, yeah, like as you said, the intent is to have consistency amongst different plans. So if you focus on and follow things like the PIM and other regulations, that should provide somewhat consistency on plans, you know, as much as possible, you know, even throughout the country. If everyone's following a manual that is a nationwide manual, now you're going to have different things like LCDs and NCDs, which are LCDs specific to like a smaller geographic area, whereas NCDs are more national. But again, those are all put in place to, with the intention of providing consistency. Now, beyond that, your organization may have specific SOPs and different policies that are more specific to your area and are probably more more focused than the national policies and PIM manual, things of that nature. But as you said, if you follow those policies, you should be, you know, if you follow those and there's still issues with the audit, it's not you, the auditor or the investigator. It's more of a management, like it's a problem with your policies more so. And that's not something that like the individual investigator or auditor should have to worry about. If you follow those policies, you should be, that should be your guardrails to keep you in line with what they're auditing, basically. The other portion of that too, I think that's important, is everybody at this point should have a compliance plan. And there's a bunch of different, this could be a whole nother discussion we've talked about before, but if, you know, there's the, was it seven pillars? It's been a while since I looked at it, but there's certain things that the OIG has set up as far as compliance recommendations and suggestions. And there's a number of things, like, you know, you have to have ongoing training. They talk about making your organization have a culture of compliance whereby people know that they can report things without, you know, getting kickback from the management. There should be reporting requirements where you can do it anonymously. All these different types of things that, again, should help you stay within your parameters and should be guidelines or guardrails.
Right.
But the whole thing on the compliance thing is it can't just be something set in on a document and you look at it once a year. It should be like a living document that you're updating. Training should be continual and consistent. But if you follow those things that are set up with a decent compliance plan, that's another set of guardrails that should keep you within all the parameters of what they're looking at in the audit. And it's not something that most of the line, you know, investigators or auditors or CPCs, whatever, should worry about. As long as the local or your SOPs are written correctly and you follow those, it's nothing you really should have to worry about as far as the audit.
And what's interesting is, you know, when we talk about the seven point, you call them the seven pillars, but yeah, it's really the OIG's model compliance guidance, the 7 point model compliance guidance. What's interesting is that those 7 points are really geared towards the provider side of business, but that doesn't mean that a plan or an SIU can't implement them as well, right? You can have a compliance committee, you can have an auditing committee, you can do self audits. You know, one thing I think that plans could really do to enhance their operational efficiency is this whole premise of self audits, right? Like, you know, we've gone in and done a bunch of scorecards and reviews on SIUs and come up with some what we think are some operational methodologies for becoming more efficient. Plans can do that. And, you know, part of that efficiency is, for example, making sure that providers have consistency in their contracts. You know, you and I are both cardiologists. Neither one of us are smart enough to do that, but in the hypothetical world, you and I are both cardiologists. We should have contracts that are relatively similar. There shouldn't be things in that contract that says that Dr. McFowell can do something, but Dr. Rubenstein can't do it. There should be some level of consistency, because if it's a similar thing and it's the same code, why would you be allowed to do it and me not be allowed to do it from a billing and coding perspective? So I think it's a great point that you're bringing up, which is that we sometimes focus on from the provider side, compliance, but we oftentimes don't think about the compliance that exists in the payer space and the fact that you should be able to have a set of compliance SOPs that may not be that dissimilar from what the OIG is talking about with compliance committees and things of that sort, self-auditing, making sure that the audits that are being done, the reviews, as because, you know, ultimately, right, the audit results in where your investigation is going to go in some cases. And so making sure that your auditors are properly trained, they have the right reference material, and that there's a level of consistency is going to be a piece of that puzzle where if you're doing all of those things, then the UPIC review should be nothing of concern. And so, Matt, let's, you know, as a former UPIC director, and I know you did these when you were at the Northeast UPIC, but I think we're seeing kind of unprecedented levels of them being done, which presents its own set of challenges. Because number one, if the UPIC is being diverted to spend its time doing plan reviews, are they then having to abdicate part of the responsibility of doing the provider reviews? Because there's only so many investigators, there's only so many people who do the audits. But, you know, we are seeing this enhancement in the level of scrutiny being placed on plans. And by the way, not to divert too much, but Mifugu reviews and audits are part of the OIG's responsibility. OIG has a team of people through its inspection group of agents and analysts that go out on a cadence and do audits and reviews at the Mifugu level. And so that's why for me, and look, we're outsiders now. So when we hear that New York gets decertified and Hawaii gets decertified, it almost begs the question of what were these reviews that were being done to an extent? And then also to an extent is when was the last one? Like, you know, we hear that Hawaii hadn't had a referral in 4 or 5 years and got paid millions and millions of dollars. We see New York is apparently one of, if not the largest Mifugu, and they didn't lead and, you know, they had 8 convictions or something. Like, I'm making up numbers. But the point being is that if the OIG is out there doing its thing, like, how is it that this was able to continue? But that's more of a hypothetical conversation for another point. But I think it's important to know, though, that the UPICs they're working in this quasi function similar to what the OIG would have been doing. But this is just kind of the course of action because the UPICs are contractors with the government and the UPICs are being tasked to go out and do this. The plans are voluntarily participating as Medicare Advantage plans or Medicaid, you know, offerings. And so, you know, there's a level of scrutiny that comes with that.
Right. When I was there, these types of audits would be ad hoc. It would be a special project that CMS would ask us to do. Can you go look at plan X? And, you know, there was an audit outline and guidelines and checklist that we would use. And are they doing this, this, and this? Now it's, and CMS used to do the vast majority of them themselves. They would go out to the plans themselves, whether it's a regional office personnel or CMS headquarters would go out and do these reviews themselves. Now it's all the UPICs are being asked to do all of them seemingly on a yearly basis to go out to these plans. And I'm sure that they're somehow chosen by size and location and things like that. But I'm hoping that CMS did reimburse the UPICs and made it a separate task order under the SOW so they could bring additional people to do them. Because if not, then this type of activity would really compromise how they can do their primary function, which is to identify fraud, waste, and abuse. Because from, you know, just our clients in New York and other states, all of them are getting reviewed. You know, and it's a lot more onerous than it was before. I mean, they are entrance conferences, exit conferences, documentation requests, interviews of staff, and they run the gamut of compliance for these plans. It's, are they in compliance with the state Medicaid plan? Are they following enrollment, member enrollment criteria and vetting? Similarly, are they doing the correct credentialing of the providers within them? Do they have a compliance unit within the plan? Are they following their own policies as well as the state policy, the state Medicaid plan policies on things like coverage and fee schedules and all of those things? And they do that, you know, as like in a regular audit by taking samples. They're looking at things. Does their SIU, whether, you know, whether it's internal or an outsourced SIU, are they set up functionally well? Do they document their cases? Are the actions taken being, are they appropriate and documented well enough to be justified and defensible? Right. All of those things are being looked at. And so for the plans, you know, following up on what Wade said, if they are following their policies, if they have the things set up that they have to have set up to be in accordance with running a Medicaid plan in that particular state, then they should be okay. It is a lot of work preparing for and going through these audits, and takes a fair amount of resources to do it. But if they're following the rules, it should be okay. And I'll give you an example of not following the rules. Let's say, you know, you've got, like in the state of New York, there's problems with a particular provider type. Let's say it's the daycare centers, the social adult daycare centers. Are there policy provisions in place that the plan is ignoring when they have a finding that this SADC is not doing such and such, or is submitting false claims or false documentation? Are they not taking action? And, you know, and the state plan is, when this happens, you should be doing X, Y, or Z. Right. And out of a fear of losing membership, are they ignoring those things and just telling the SADC, just keep doing what you're doing?
Well, being in violation of such and such it's a lot of yada, yada, yada. So it's very important.
It is, blah, blah, blah.
If you're in violation of such and such, you got to really get your act together. But yeah. And so, you know, the thing, Matt, is that like we have one or two plans that have asked us to come in and provide some logistical mm-hmm. assistance on these. And mostly it's kind of doing like a QA review of the medical record review, like having one of our lead auditors come in and take a look and see, you know. And I think, you know, at the end of the, you know, analysis, did the auditor from the plan have all of the requisite information that was needed at the time? Because a lot of the questions that are going to come about are going to be, if the auditor's findings are different than the QA auditor, let's say the UPIC or us, if it's different, the question is going to be, when we're looking back historically, did the auditor who did that initial audit for the plan, did they have all of the proper requisite information that they needed? Was the policy for the right? You know, the biggest thing that we see in a lot of these cases is that the policy being applied was superseded, sunset. There was a change to that policy. And while you may be looking at an NCD or an LCD or a plan policy, the question is going to be, was it the right policy that was applied for the right period of time? And I think the biggest challenge is when there's a policy change, and that policy change takes effect during a span of a record review, and you have one policy in effect at one time, one policy in effect at another time, but you have continuity of care for the patient. And I think that's the thing that sometimes becomes the biggest stumble, is that the auditor is not realizing that there was a change in that policy. And so, you know, that becomes something that, you know, that becomes corrective action for the PI team and all of that. So, you know, some of these are things where there isn't an intent. I don't think the SIUs aren't intending to do, you know, malfeasance. These are really process issues that come about as a result of changes in policy that occur during an audit period.
Correct. Or there's, going back to what we were talking about, a special provision in that provider's contract that the auditor didn't know about.
And we see that happening. We see it a lot. And it's sometimes a head scratcher for us, because it's like, how do two providers who are in network not have the same requirements for that contract? It is oftentimes a head scratcher. So the takeaways, I think, for us to, you know, for those that for those that spend their time on listening to us on this podcast, the takeaways are continue to do the work. For the line investigators, you're not making managerial decisions. You're getting a case, you're working the case, and then moving on. I think the takeaway is to continue to do that. However, the takeaway is also if you're finding anomalies in the application of a policy or something, it's incumbent upon you to bring that to someone's attention for clarity purposes, both because some of that clarity is going to be a way that's going to direct you on where your investigation goes. And then from the overall managerial and leadership perspective, it's just making sure that you're staying the course and that you're staying the course with those policies. I mean, I remember, you guys remember this, when the healthcare fraud statutes were passed and an 18 USC 1347 came out and you had cases that you were working on in which prior to 18 USC 1347, we were using 18 USC 286 and 287, conspiracy to file false claims and false claims criminal, which is kind of the generic criminal statute. And then all of a sudden, healthcare fraud statutes come out. And prosecutors were at a fork in the road, right? They had a Robert Frost moment, the road not taken, because what do? Do you just continue to do you charge everything under the 286, 287, or do you bifurcate that behavior and then you charge 286, 287 on one and 1347 or 1349 on another? And I had that happen on a few cases. And so when you have a policy, it's a little bit different because at least with 286, 287, you could have at least charged throughout that continuity of that behavior and then not had to deal with the change in the statute. Policy is a little different. The policy changes and you could be in the middle of looking at a review and you're going to have claims that you're going to submit, that the provider submitted, that are for a time period from one policy and then another period of time with a change in that policy. So from a managerial perspective, it's just important that your SIU team, your auditors are up to date on all of the latest and greatest that's going on so that you don't have an issue in which there is an inapplicable statute, inapplicable policy being applied to that. So, you know, just a few things to keep in mind. Again, you know, the day-to-day of an SIU investigator shouldn't just be moving the pieces of paper from the desk from one side to the other. There should be some intuitive thought process that goes on. There should be some conversations that occur with the people that are out there. And the big takeaway is just keep doing your job. And the fact that you have an audit that's coming in or a review from the UPIC shouldn't change the way you operate on the day-to-day. But whatever those findings are from the UPIC should just be for, you know, it's go forward information. It's how to fix things, how to be corrective, and how to get to where you should be to ultimately make your day a little bit easier.
I think that's the one thing too that probably at least the, you know, line investigators or auditors don't really see the big picture. And if you step back and look at what's the purpose of these audits, as you're the subject of an audit, or maybe if you want to say the victim of being audited, but if you look back and say they're looking for, whether it be CMS or the UPIC, they're looking for findings. So what's, you know, what are the issues that are not meeting the criteria that is set out there? And then they're going to look for a root cause analysis. Why did this happen? Let's get to the bottom of it. Then they're going to look at impact analysis. What did this impact as far as beneficiaries? You know, what's the overarching impact? And then they're going to, usually if there's enough impact, I guess, is they're going to come up with a corrective action plan. So let's make sure this doesn't happen. If we do this same audit next year, we're going to correct these problems and we won't have these same findings next year. And a lot of times I think that's lost on the person that's doing the investigation or the audit.
And that's a great point, Wade, as we close out, is that there may be findings that are really just informational findings that have no impact on the work that you do. It could just be an informational finding. And so you still should look at them, because an informational finding is something that you deal with it just to deal with it, where it's not impacting that work, versus things that require corrective action because there was a systemic problem. You know, we see all the time instances where there's just an anecdotal finding that doesn't impact the operation of the organization. Investigator submitted an update on a case at 35 days versus 30. Informational finding doesn't impact the investigation itself. That's just a, you know, just one example. So yeah, stay the course, keep doing what you're doing. If you're an SIU investigator at a plan that's going through a UPIC investigation, review, audit, whatever, don't panic. You know, just keep doing what you're doing. And we're always here to help and answer those questions and give you our insights and our thoughts. So stick with it. Good to see you, Wade. Welcome back for this week. Yeah. I guess we'll see. We'll see what happens. Yeah. We'll see what happens. But at least we know that you're working, because the word is that your lawn is in dire need of a mowing. So
this is true.
I know, it's sad. It's a sad day. So we're gonna get Makachansky out there to make sure that your lawn is properly mowed over the next couple of weeks. So yeah, it's good. It's good stuff.
Perfect.
We appreciate everybody spending. It's good to have you back. We appreciate everybody spending their time. We got lots of LinkedIn Lives planned over the next couple of months. And again, the newsletter, blogs, all that stuff continues to come out. Just sign up on the newsletter. Join us on LinkedIn. And until next time, we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable. Have a good day, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.